This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
You know, not surprisingly, there are a bunch of Trump books out or coming out this year, but we've been looking forward particularly to hosting Mark Singer and his new book, Trump and Me. Mark has been a staff writer at The New Yorker for I guess his whole life, or at least for the past 42 years. In that time, he's contributed countless numbers of talk of the town items and scores of profiles and reporting pieces. He's also written several previous books, which either originated from articles that he had done or were collections of his articles. And now he's shown that he's shamelessly not above capitalizing on Trump's notoriety by repackaging one of his best and most famous profiles, which was about Trump and published 19 years ago. And we, of course, are also shamelessly not above holding an event for Mark and promoting the heck out of his book. And the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, was not above writing an introduction for Mark's book. He said Mark has provided us with, quote, the best, most insightful, and funniest portrait of Trump. And he called Mark's profile, quote, a classic of the form. My favorite endorsement of Mark, though, and his apparent favorite, too, is from Trump himself. It was something Trump wrote about a collection of Mark's stories published a decade ago, and it's the sole blurb on the back of Mark's book. Mark, you are a total loser, and your book and writings sucks. Need more be said, right? As an added attraction, Jane Mayer, another great New Yorker writer and one of the country's foremost investigative journalists, is here to be in conversation with Mark. Jane's articles or books have probed, among other things, the rise of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, the mistreatment of detainees under the Bush administration, and the use of drones and the prosecution of whistleblowers in the Obama years. Her latest book, Dark Money, is a very impressive, well-documented account of efforts by the Koch brothers and their allies to reshape the U.S. political system. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming both Mark and Jane.
Welcome, everybody. I also want to welcome Mark to Washington. Mark and I share something in common other than The New Yorker. We both had the same writing teacher at Yale University. And the strange thing is his name's Bill Zinsser. He was just a wonderful writer. And he taught Mark a very serious course that was how to, you know, be a serious nonfiction writer. And I took a humor writing class with him, and it ends up I'm writing these deadly serious books that all start with like the dark this and the dark that, and Mark has written in this book, I can't recommend it too much, is truly one of the funniest pieces of political writing and really any writing. I was just rereading it before coming over here and just sitting there laughing out loud. It's just fantastic. So anyway, I'm very happy to be here with Mark. And I guess you wanted to start by doing a little reading. Is that okay? Mark's going to give us a little taste of this book.
Although after that, I just as soon leave. And leave. This is the very first chapter of this very short book. And it is called One-on-One. It's the fall of 1996. I've been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1974. I worked for a number of editors, and at this point, Tina Brown is the editor. Those proverbial tales of adversarial relationships between writers and editors, I've managed to avoid all that. I need my glasses.
me that Eustace Tilly look. Okay.
Not blind person look. Those proverbial tales of adversarial relationships between writers and editors, I've managed to avoid all that. I like Tina. She and I have a clear working understanding. I've just spent 4 years writing a book that was supposed to have taken me a year and a half, during which I haven't been available to write many pieces for the magazine. So our understanding is that in Tina's office, in her desk, there is a special drawer. In that drawer is a jar. In that jar are my testicles. One morning, my phone rings. Tina, Trump, Donald Trump. I've just had breakfast with him at the Plaza. You're going to write a profile of him. You're absolutely going to love him. He's totally full of shit. You'll love him. I told him he'll love you. You're doing it. Which indicates that I am doing it. I get to work. This takes several months. I go places with Trump. I try to understand his ways of doing business, the nuts and bolts, the smoke and mirrors. Early on, we reach our own working understanding. I tacitly accede to his assumption that I am his tool. It's Trump's world. I may watch and listen and occasionally ask questions. When permitted, I am a fly on the wall. Otherwise, as far as he's concerned, I don't really exist. This, by the way, I regard as optimal working conditions. Unaccustomed though I am, I have to take Donald Trump seriously. Among other tasks, I must read many books with his name and photograph on the cover, ghostwritten books ostensibly composed by Trump. The overarching theme of this oeuvre would echo several years later, greatly amplified in The Apprentice. We both know that you're a complete putz, but you're at least allowed to fantasize about what my life is like. And that is, in fact, what I want to do. During our first encounter in his office in Trump Tower, I grasped that whoever or whatever I had previously imagined Trump to be, he is foremost a performance artist. Appearance is never not, at some level, artifice. My objective is to apprehend the person within the persona. Many books and hundreds of articles have often been written about Trump, and I read those too. There's no point in asking Trump questions he's answered in print already. Anyway, I can come up with a few new ones. Say, does Donald Trump have an interior life? No one's ever asked him that, I bet. One Saturday in the winter of 1997, he and I spend a morning and afternoon one-on-one, touring construction projects in Manhattan, office building, and north of New York City in Westchester County, golf courses. He drives, and I sit in the death seat, taking notes. As we cruise up Interstate 684, I ask about his early morning routines. What time do you wake up? 5:30 a.m. What time do you arrive at your desk in the Trump Tower? 7 or 7:30. How do you spend your time before leaving the office, reading the newspapers, etc.? Okay, I say, you're basically alone. Your wife is still asleep. He was then married, but not for much longer, to his second wife, Marla Maples. You're in the bathroom shaving, and you see yourself in the mirror. What are you thinking? From Trump, a look of incomprehension. Me. I mean, are you looking at yourself and thinking, wow, I'm Donald Trump? Trump remains puzzled. Me. Okay, I guess I'm asking, do you consider yourself ideal company? At the time, I deemed Trump's reply unprintable. But that was then. Trump, you really want to know what I consider ideal company? Yes, Trump. A total piece of ass. Nobody like that? No? On other occasions, for different reasons, I'm baffled by particular Trumpian locutions. He prefaces certain statements with, off the record, but you can use it. This makes as much sense as his taxonomy of the real estate he sells. Luxury, super luxury, and super, super luxury. Spring arrives, and the profile is almost finished. I have everything but an ending. I also have a deadline. late on a Thursday night, I faxed the story. Remember those faxes? I faxed the story, 10,000 words, still no ending, to my editor. Ready for bed, I tapped the clock radio on my night table, which is tuned to an all-news station. Top of the hour. The headline is, Donald Trump and Marla Maples are separating. Inconveniently, I've seen none of this coming. Conveniently, my article has abruptly become timely. Trump agrees to meet with me in his office the following Monday, and my reward is an ending, an opening scene, and a crystal uncertainty about his interior life. Given his domestic vicissitudes, is he happy, regretful, self-reflective? His demeanor gives away nothing. Previously, he's told me that in times of distress, he confides in no one. Meanwhile, I've interviewed dozens of Trump associates and acquaintances, among them a securities analyst who observes, deep down, he wants to be Madonna. All of which informs my conclusion that he does not have an interior life. The penultimate line, he had aspired to and achieved the ultimate luxury, an existence unmolested by the rumbling of a soul. Evidently, Trump does not appreciate what I've written. I don't hear from him directly, but he writes a spurned lover's complaint to Tina. Don't ever ask me to do another story. You said it'll be great. You'll love it. You lied. The nerve. Later that year, I gain a finer appreciation of his feelings toward me. He publishes Trump, The Art of the Comeback, ghostwritten by Kate Boner, and devotes a few pages to Tina and me. He recounts that years earlier, when Tina was the editor of Vanity Fair, she had assigned Marie Brenner, according to Trump, an unattractive reporter, to write about him. For whatever reason, Trump omits what he once told me about how he'd exacted revenge by pouring red wine down Marie's dress at a charity dinner. There I am on page 181 in the chapter The Press and Other Germs. On the facing page is a photograph of Trump with Liberace, and the caption, Liberace was a great performer and a great man. We all miss him dearly. How true. Tina Brown was at it again, asking me to agree to a profile. She is a very persuasive woman. She told me, you will love the piece, you'll absolutely love it. After listening a while, I agreed. I thought, how many editors call someone for breakfast in order to convince him to do a story that they could write without him anyway? The next day, I got a call from the New Yorker's reporter, Mark Singer. When he came into the office, I immediately sensed that he was not much of anything. Nondescript, with a faint wise guy sneer and some kind of chip on his shoulder. Singer reminded me a bit of Harry Hurt, a guy who wrote an inaccurate book about me. While Singer was slightly more physically attractive than Harry Hurt, which, by the way, wasn't difficult, Singer had scar written all over him. Reading and rereading and rereading, this affirms incontrovertibly that my life has meaning. Other than the births of my children, nothing remotely this wonderful has ever happened. Should all else fall through or fade away, I will still have Trump, The Art of the Comeback. Now it's 2005. I publish a book, Character Studies, that includes my reporting on Trump. In the Sunday New York Times, it's reviewed by Jeff McGregor, who strikes me as a terrifically perceptive fellow, though he does have one quibble. The only instance in which Singer throws and lands a sucker punch is in a 1997 profile of the pre-apprentice Donald Trump, in which his tone becomes a little arch. That Trump is already a caricature of a caricature makes him too easy a target, with neither the foot speed nor the wit to defend himself. Think again, McGregor. 3 weeks later, the Times Book Review features a letter from Trump about this review. A few days before the letter's publication, I learned that it's coming and decide to check my sales on Amazon. Alas, Character Studies is number 45,638 on the bestseller list. No matter, Trump's letter is sublimely deranged. To the editor, I can remember when Tina Brown was in charge of The New Yorker, and a writer named Mark Singer interviewed me for a profile. He was depressed. I was thinking, okay, expect the worst. Not only was Tina Brown dragging The New Yorker to a new low, this writer was drowning in his own misery, which could only put me in a skeptical mood regarding the outcome of their combined interests in me. Misery begets misery. And they were a perfect example of this credo. Jeff McGregor, the reviewer of Character Studies, a collection of Singer's New Yorker profiles, including the one about me, writes poorly. Maybe he and Singer belong together. Some people cast shadows, and other people choose to live in those shadows. To each his own. They are entitled to their choices. Most writers want to be successful. Some writers even want to be good writers. I've read John Updike. I've read Orhan Pamuk. I've read Philip Roth. When Mark Singer enters the L League, maybe I'll read one of his books, but it will be a long time. He was not born with great writing ability. Maybe he should try to develop himself into a world-class writer, as futile as that might be, instead of having to write about remarkable people who are clearly outside of his realm. I've been a best-selling author for 20 years, close to 20 years. Whether you like it or not, facts are facts. The highly respected Joe Queenan mentioned in his article, Ghosts in the Machine, March 20th, letter to the Times, article in the book review. Joe Queenan mentioned in his article, Ghosts in the Machine, that I had produced, quote, a steady stream of classics, close quote, with stylistic seamlessness, and that the voice of my books remained noticeably constant to the point of being, quote, an astonishing accomplishment. And I have a footnote here that says, lacking any aptitude for irony, Trump is blithely oblivious to Queenan's. This was high praise coming from an accomplished writer. From losers like Jeff McGregor, whom I've never met, or Mark Singer, I do not do nearly as well. But I'll gladly take Joe Queenan over Singer and McGregor any of the day of the week. It's a simple thing called talent. I have no doubt that Singer's and McGregor's books will do badly. They just don't have what it takes. Maybe someday they'll astonish us by writing something of consequence. Donald Trump, New York. Within 48 hours, several fellow scribblers solicited advice on how to provoke Trump into attacking them. My book rockets to number 385 on the Amazon list. And I hear my mother's voice reminding me to write a thank you note. But I want to acknowledge my appreciation with more than a mere note. What should I send Trump? What is he like? Money. I decide to send him $1,000. Then it occurs to me that I don't have $1,000. I come up with another figure. Dear Donald, thank you so much for that wonderful letter to the New York Times Book Review. A number of friends have called or written to say that it's one of the funniest things they've read in a long time. Though I'm sure that you, as an author, are aware that it's considered bad form to pay the people who review one's books, I nevertheless enclose a check for $37.82, a small token of my enormous gratitude. You're special to me. Also, I enclose a couple of Band-Aids. Because you seem unable to stop picking at this particular scab, these should come in handy. Cheerfully, Mark. I suspect that's not going to be the end of it. And indeed, 10 days later, I receive an envelope embossed with the Trump Organization logo and return address. Inside is my letter. Trump has returned it and inscribed in thick black all caps, Mark, you are a total loser and your book and writings sucks. Best wishes, Donald. P.S., and I hear it is selling badly. To his credit, he's correct about my anemic book sales. My Amazon ranking is already back down to 53,876. Then one more thing happens. I get a letter from Citibank. I open it. Inside is my bank statement. My account, I see, is $37.82 lighter. Trump has cashed the check. Can I go now?
No. And it keeps getting funnier, even. So that was great. You've also published something very recently in The New Yorker. I don't know if we should trump your Trump book, but it's a comment piece in which you float the idea that Trump might, at this point, have something of a death wish, almost, that he is... The question you pose is he really trying to win, or is he hoping that he won't? So what do you think? You know him as well as anyone who's reported on him.
I'm in the same position as everyone in this room, which is I'm watching this from my living room couch, and unless you're closer, good luck. But I'm just watching what's been going on, and there are people. I thought this quite a while ago, and the evidence of it, it's circumstantial, of course, but. And I raise these questions in this comment piece in this week's magazine. Would a person who really wants to be elected run without a staff, without a ground game state to state, without a fundraising network, without any regard for policy nuances, no concept of governance, and all the other things that one does to prepare. I mean, I'm just today, can you imagine Trump debating Hillary Clinton? I mean, that is going to be bigger than the Super Bowl. It really is. Just looking at it all, look at it this week. I mean, she has the worst week politically that she's had since she began to campaign, I believe. What does he do? He talks about how much he loves Saddam Hussein. He talks about an anti-Semitic tweet from a right-wing website that he has forwarded, and then refuses to back down anyway or apologize. There are a couple more things, but everything he could do to shoot himself in the foot and fail to capitalize on the FBI report, he managed to do. And there could be other, inferences to draw from this, but that's what it seems to me. And he refuses to be managed. I mean, actually, since Dallas, 48 hours ago, if I lost track of, was it Thursday? It was Thursday night, yeah. He actually sat in his office and gave a statement using a teleprompter. But he'll be back at it within another 48 hours because he really... Now, does that mean he has a death wish? I think his greatest fear is losing, period. And so I think he's at best very conflicted about it.
Well, but as you write, this is not even his first bid for the presidency. He actually has tried it numerous times, right? We just didn't pay that much attention before. So why, if he doesn't really want to win, and the worst thing he can say about someone is they are a loser, why does he keep putting himself in this position? What's making him run?
Well, his ego is... there's nothing like it, really. I mean, we've never witnessed anyone like this that I'm aware of in public life. I mean, people, compare Donald Trump to P.T. Barnum, but P.T. Barnum was promoting other acts and things like this, and he's been promoting himself. There is no real Donald Trump. There is, quote, Donald Trump, unquote. He is his brand. That's why I describe the challenge of originally writing about him as getting at the person beneath the persona. And he's predicated his whole existence on leveraging his name, Donald Trump. And everything that he's ever done, I've thought, has been calculated as an extension of the brand. he's not a details person, plainly, and I just think that he thought this was going to be fun, and oh well, I'm leaving out an important detail. Many of you might have seen this in March. There was an article that appeared online, but it got some circulation. A woman named Stephanie Segielski, who was a was the erstwhile sort of PR person, communications director for a Trump PAC, the Make America Great PAC. It was another word in that, but anyway. Make America Great Again PAC, but there was some other before PAC, whatever it was. She published this piece describing how a year earlier, so we're talking March of 2015, she was in a meeting where she was told, she's just gotten this job, that his goal, he was going to run for president. Nobody knew yet that he was going to run for sure, and that he wanted to poll at 12% and finish second behind somebody who would get 50% of the delegates. So I really think that this was not expected by him, that he would be in this position.
So it was brand enhancement for his business, and now he's stuck.
I think so. I really do. It's really risky to psychoanalyze people, but what the hell? No, it is. It is. I mean, it just seems consistent with whatever else you've observed about him. He just wants to hear his name shouted from the public, and he responds to it.
Did you find him in any way unexpectedly charming, or does he have hidden strengths that explain how he's gotten this far? I mean, what was he like when you're in the room with him, which is something most of us will maybe never experience?
I owe everyone here an answer to that question, but I might have repressed it. I mean, you're in the room. Well, I describe this business of, you disappear. You're a fly on the wall. The gift of Donald Trump is that he's not interested in other people. The gift, if you're a reporter, he has no curiosity about anyone else.
He didn't ask anything about your life?
No. We never discussed me.
How long were you reporting on this?
Several months. I mean, I was only spending, over that period of time, maybe cumulatively 10 days. I mean, if we're talking, 10 or 12 days. But I was never dropping in on him. I was going places where I was invited. I really don't ask questions unless I have to. And I was just observing. And I tend to have a sort of cinematic way of writing profiles. I mean, they're scenes with dialogue and exposition. And so I was just gathering material for that. And they were great scenes. It was entertaining. I mean, it was clear that he was just a bullshitter, but that wasn't a real revelation. But there's a scene in the original profile. It's in this book where he's in a room. He gets a visit from a Russian general, Alexander Lebed, who really was serious about becoming the president of Russia. Was visiting the States and wanted to meet Trump because he thought that would give him credibility. When he ran politically back in Russia, and it was the strangest scene, because he knew nothing about Lebed. I don't know what Lebed thought he was doing with Trump, but Trump quickly exhausted after about 2 or 3 minutes his knowledge of Russia, and so they ended up talking about, Shaquille O'Neal's shoe that Trump had there, or an Evander Holyfield boxing glove that he was very proud of. And then Trump showed him a magazine with a photo spread on Mar-a-Lago. And whoa. And so I'm not ever thinking that I'm witnessing anyone who functions like the rest of us. Charm was not part of it. I didn't find him oppressive to be with. I flew on his plane down to Mar-a-Lago with a bunch of other people, and it was kind of entertaining to observe it. I'll say that. I happened to be in Palm Beach, though. It was February, I guess, or January, and the temperature was about 36 degrees. And I've never been colder in my life. I probably had a jacket like this. And I spent most of the time, as much as I could, in my $1,000 a night suite at Mar-a-Lago, sort of under the covers in fetal position. And he just, you would be invited out for another piece of the show. But the kind of thing that human beings do, no.
Well, I mean, you point out in the book that he is nothing but ratings magic on TV. You quote one of the TV executives saying, "Well, he may be bad for the country, but he sure is great for my network."
Right. And it's Leslie Moonves, right, of CBS, and that's why I never watch CBS. Because he said, "Yeah, it may be bad for the country, but it's great for us. Bring it on, Donald."
Well, so but what is that thing? Because he dispatched many, many rivals in the.
He's a celebrity, Celebrity Apprentice. Apprentice. I mean, that was it. You had 17 people running. Who's the one name they've heard, and who's the one person who is truly entertaining? Whether you're watching him on Fox or MSNBC. He's entertaining. He might be horrifying entertaining. He might be saying what you hear entertaining, but this is a fact about this person. And I vowed when all of this began, you know, that I was not going to write about it.
And why is that?
I didn't want to add to the discussion at the beginning, you know, last summer. I just didn't want to contribute to the Trumpomania. So that was the only thing I got right. The thing I got right, actually, but I have no proof of this, was that, but I really did think, having witnessed his birtherism, which I found, you know, more beyond appalling, and I did write about that at the time, but I just, you know, John Stewart and everybody's going, thank you, thank you, thank you for this, for the Trump candidacy, and I just said, this is... It might seem like it's great for satire. It's not good for anybody else. It's not good for the country. It's not good for the world. He's hurt us, obviously, our standing internationally already. And so I got that right, but the rest, everybody got wrong. I didn't see the rest coming at all. Wouldn't have predicted it.
When you imagine this Super Bowl-like debate with Hillary Clinton, I'm curious, given his... relationships with women, which sort of are confined to things like Miss Universe and his three wives and all that. How does he interface with women? Because he had a secretary, didn't he, who was constantly in his life and was an older woman who was actually
yes.
kind of a solid citizen. I mean, is there a secret Donald Trump that respects women and that might know how to take Hillary on in a different way? Or
I believe that he respects certain individuals. This woman, Norma Federer. Who was his right-hand person who was around when I was around, she really, they had a really wonderful relationship as far as I can tell.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Well, she was a lot older than he was. And I think, I'm not saying that it was maternal, but she knew how to manage him. Mm-hmm. And there are plainly people who have worked for him who didn't have negative experiences, women, but I think they're in the minority. Everything we've heard, I mean, you don't have to go very far to get a pretty clear picture of Trump's idea of what women are. I mean, they're really foreign planets to him.
Did you see much family life?
No, and that's another thing. This is, I don't know how safe this room is, but, you know, I've seen him use his children as props. And he said things about raising children. He wasn't going to have anything to do. No reading at night, no changing diapers, none of the things that I think are really okay for a father to do. And he just has contempt for all that. He sees it as weakness. I don't even know what decade that is a throwback to. But he kind of bragged about it. You know, he'd say, women, you got to treat them like shit. You know, there was that quote somewhere, and maybe with Howard Stern. He said, I'm not going to say some of the things that he said about, you know, women on Howard Stern's show. You can Google it. But so I think that he recognizes that that Hillary Clinton is very smart. He's going to go as low as he can. This is really going to depend on the moderators. The moderators have to control this thing.
That's interesting. Well, should we go to some questions from the audience? Does anybody have a question here?
Could you come to the mic, please?
Hi. I have a question to follow up on the comments about women. He has an older sister, Marianne Barry, who is a retired judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, who was appointed first in her first level judgeship, I believe, by George H.W. Bush, and then by Clinton to the Third Circuit. She is a well-regarded judge. She's well-respected, and she's 8 or 9 years older than he is. What is their relationship?
I think it's a good relationship, but I don't know more than that. She doesn't talk to reporters. She's made some very blanket statements about her brother that are, you know, indicative of loyalty, but I have no idea beyond that. And I never met her. I don't really know much about her other than what you've just said.
Just following up on that, was it possible when you're doing a piece like this to find people who really knew him well, or are there no people other than maybe his immediate family who really do know him that well? Does he have close friends? Does he have a big universe of people who are in his life?
Well, if he has close friends, and I don't really, I have a very specific definition of friend. You know, there are, you know, there I have a small number of people who are my, you know, friends, you know, close to my heart, trust with my children's lives, friends. So it's a tricky term, friend. And he talks about his friends everywhere. This is a guy who stands up at every rally and tells everyone how much he loves them. I have enormous difficulty imagining him loving anyone, as I understand love, where you subordinate your own needs to another person's. That I don't see in him. And when I went to see him the Monday after he'd gotten through the weekend, when he had announced the previous Thursday that he and his wife were separating, I get in to see him in his office, and we were having a conversation. I had asked him actually months earlier, and when I was in his office, it confirmed this. I'd asked him who he confided in moments of tribulation, and he said, "No one." It's not my thing, and I that says a lot. That kind of naked intimacy that most of us have with certain people in our lives, I have a hard time imagining that.
Should you want to take the next here?
In the spirit of brand management, the period of your interviews roughly overlaps with the 25th. Class reunion, and he was a matter of chatter among classmates, and I don't think any of us had ever met him personally.
Class reunion where?
Wharton.
At Wharton.
So the sense that we had was that he had been telling people that he had never learned anything at Wharton. So somewhere along the line, he decided evidently that this was something he wanted to embrace as part of his brand management. And by the time of his interview a couple of years ago at the National Press Club, he had done that fully. So my question is, did that come up at all during the time you spent with him?
That's a really good question. I don't remember having a discussion about it. He did embrace Wharton later. He never mentions that he went to Fordham for 2 years before he transferred to Penn. And what he does say is that I was the smartest guy there was in the top of my class, which is, to be fair, bullshit. And I think if there was a way that it seemed that he could use it, yes. But I don't believe that he managed to discuss it. So,
oh, over over here, this side? Okay.
Yep.
Sorry.
Yes, thank you. Much of what you described and what we know about him is what he says. And much of what you reported today is what does he say about people, etc. What can you tell us a little bit more about his behavior, especially with his kids? Does he make the same speeches to them? Does he treat them in what particular way? Because behavior, to me, is a great indication that there might be a difference between a man who just speaks or a woman who just speaks and follows it in a certain way. So tell us about his behavior.
Well, I only observed him with two of his children. His fourth born child, which it was a daughter that he had with Marla Maples, named Tiffany, who was maybe a toddler when I was around. I do remember thinking that I assumed that she was couldn't walk because she was being carried everywhere. But that's just the way they raised her, I guess. She can walk. And then his son Eric, who you see now, who's about 13, and I didn't really see any interaction that was noteworthy except that he was with us on he was on a flight with me down to you know, Palm Beach one weekend, and I apologize if I can't give you more specifics than that, but what I do observe is his children are resolutely loyal, and he does respect his daughter. And she plainly is the one with all the brains. And the sons are kind of sad. They really seem like deeply insecure people. But they are either in awe of their father or they're so needy for his attention that they stay as close as they can. And they all work for him or whatever that means. So I'm sorry, I don't have more specifics.
That's interesting. We've got another question here.
Hi. I wanted to ask a little bit about when he speaks, the relationship with the crowd. I mean, there have been some people have talked about, clearly we've heard a lot about how he whips people up, but then also some discussion of sort of the crowd to him. And Dave Eggers wrote a piece where he talks about almost people seem to be there almost to see him as an entertainment, and I think compared it to audiences going to see Henry Dice Clay, I think it was. But then the other night, the speech that has gotten so much comment that for his rambling all over the other night, it seemed to me watching it almost as if the crowd was more controlling what he was saying than his having the crowd in his control the way good political speakers frequently do. And I wondered if you had a comment on that.
Are you talking about the mosquito speech?
After the mosquito speech, the one I think, the one where he totally rambled and Dave Plouffe even tweeted that they should broadcast it.
No, that was the mosquito speech.
Was that the same speech?
Yes.
Okay.
This was the one in Cincinnati the other night?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Before I came over here, I happened to look at the New Yorker's website, and David Remnick has written a comment in which he reaches a conclusion that I had reached independently. We actually happened to discuss it a couple of days ago. It looked like he's really losing it. Mm-hmm. It truly seemed that night as if he's coming unglued. And I've said it to, you know, friends, but it's terrible to make predictions in this business. We all know that. And so everything I say could be just flat wrong. But I thought, starting around the time he attacked a Judge Curiel, I thought before that I was really afraid that he could win the election. After that, not so much. And that attack on Judge Curiel seemed to me evidence of just some stress that I really started to believe that he's not going to make it to November one way or another. Because the stress is getting to him. He has said, getting back to the first part of your question, he said to the New York Times editorial board earlier this year, or maybe it was last fall, but I think it was this year. It was this year. That when he's out there and he's talking to the crowd and he says, if I see people's attention drifting a little bit, if it looks like, you know, they're getting bored, I just say, we're going to build the wall. And they all... So they all go crazy, and this was a very revealing thing because it did show that this was a conscious manipulation, but that part of that manipulation was derived from something he's sensing from the crowd. I don't know enough about the history of great demagogues, but he seems to have got it down for the most part. I mean, because I think demagogues always have been able to do that, whip the crowd into a certain kind of frenzy, Father Coughlin, whatever. And
the most recent one, it almost seemed like the crowd was driving him. There were places where he was slowing down and somebody would say something, and it was almost like he was jumping to the crowd, which was different than, it seemed to me different than what I'd watched him before, but I may be wrong.
Well, I've written this now in this week's issue of The New Yorker, where I just say his words seem, paradoxically both calculated and careless. And I really do think that that's this divide, sort of rhetorical divide within him. And I don't know how you reconcile it, but he doesn't seem at all mentally healthy to me.
Is one of the things I wondered, because you did, let's see, your interview would have been 1996 for the...
Six and seven.
Does he seem very different, the Trump you're seeing now, than the one you saw back in 1996?
No. And the only thing that's different, particularly in the years
better
since...
Better hair?
No, no, definitely not that. No, I did not see a Donald Trump. I didn't see racism. I never thought that. I was in his office one day when he was on the phone with Jesse Jackson talking about space that he was giving to the Rainbow Coalition downtown New York, and they seemed to have a friendship. I could hear it, and so I did not see that coming, 2011, and I don't even like to speculate about what that is about.
Well, maybe you've just about answered this, but I dug out your earlier article when I was going to come see, and I thought you said grudgingly that he was he had a certain charm back then, and so do you think he's gotten worse, or do I misremember?
No, I think I don't remember. In other words, whatever I wrote is what I thought at the time. And I know that I wrote somewhere that I found him at times, either charming or almost likable, I remember just one-on-one conversation I was having with him in Florida, where I did tell him one thing about myself at that point, and it wasn't a big thing. It was just that I knew somebody who I knew he knew because I'd grown up with this person. It was just some plutocrat from my hometown, and he seemed to, that seemed to warm him up a little bit or create some moment of shared something. But so I think that he could have been there was some affability to him, but for the most part, there was not a real person there, is what I'm.
I wonder, many public figures seem to sort of avoid controversy and bad publicity, but he seems in many ways to kind of relish it. And, going back many years now, back to his tabloid days in New York, the best sex I ever had episode with Marla Maples, that he really, really likes being on the front page, and no matter what the headline says, it's all good for him.
Right.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about his peculiar relationship with bad publicity and how this might be his strategy, even in this campaign.
I think he's always operated on the principle that there's no such thing as bad publicity. That moment when he was separating from Marla Maples and separating from Ivana, his first wife, and it was a big story in the tabloids in New York, and her people were spinning it one way, and he was late in the game, and he was trying to spin it his way. And so I wrote in 1997 which was what the story was, which this headline, best sex I ever had, which an acquaintance of Marla's, I said, had blabbed to the paper. I also point out that this headline, Best Sex I Ever Had, was regarded as the most libel-proof headline in the history of the New York Post. You know, when this thing came up during the debates here, and Marco Rubio talking about his hands, and Trump just unbelievably, you know, goes there, and he starts bragging about his hands, and I went, oh my God, I got this completely wrong. When I first wrote this, it wasn't an acquaintance of Marla's that had blabbed to the Post. It was Trump that had fed that to the Post, because he was always calling up people, impersonating other people. All this came out. So I just think he had to believe that there was no such thing as bad publicity. And but he also is so arrogant, so out of touch with, I think, himself as well as the world beyond, that he never began to calculate how tricky it is to run for president.
Although, if I could follow just really quickly, everything, as you mentioned earlier, he's said so many things about John McCain, about the judge, that would seem to be disqualifying almost. The thing that would kill a campaign, he has managed to use and spin to his advantage.
Yes.
Is that more calculating than careless?
That I've yet to figure out. I still can't get over that he survived the John McCain thing. And people haven't forgotten it the way they've forgotten a lot of other horrible things he's said and done because of the aggregation of them. But I think that one of the things that's really important to understand is his supporters. We have a wonderful piece by George Saunders in this week's New Yorker about it. And he just has tapped into, you know, this resentment of elites that I have to thank him for helping me understand that. I seriously mean that. I'm guilty of being an elite. And I think that we aren't in touch with the feelings of a certain percentage of the populace. That's why people couldn't understand the Tea Party. I now understand it. I now understand that those people aren't all racists either. They've really been screwed. They've really had no one representing them. The Republican Party, you know, the Southern Strategy, pulled in all these people. It's done diddly squat for them. They've kept voting that way, but Trump is just playing the same game.
Isn't it interesting? He's fairly elite himself. I mean, he talks about Wharton, but I was just reading that when his father Fred died, that he left. They sold off his real estate holdings. And it brought in a windfall to Trump and his siblings of $520 million. It's not exactly a humble, up-from-nowhere beginning in life. Yet somehow he manages to capture the anger of the kind of the underdog, doesn't he?
Well, he's always had a populist following. He's had it in New York forever. The tabloids loved him, but because he was good copy, reporters loved him as a character, because he was good copy. I was with him once. It's in the book. We were at a building dedication at Columbus Circle, the Trump International Hotel, whatever. There's a ceremony there. There's blah blah blah. Trump works the room, leaves. He go into his car. He's got to go all the way back to 57th and 5th, but he needs a limo. And so he's in the car, and he jumps out of the car. And Trump was broke by then, so he really had only back-end equity in this whole building. His name was on it, but it was somebody else's money. But he had the parking lot concession. He had the and a share in the restaurant, which turned out to be a good, valuable thing. And he jumps out of the car and goes over. He said, I just want to go talk to these Kinney's guys. That's the parking lot vendor. And he goes over to him and he says, listen, fellas, I just want to know you're going to have a job here for as long as you want it. And I thought that was impressive. I thought this was a true man of the people, visceral kind of thing. That was one of the truly genuine moments I saw in Trump. It didn't seem invented. It didn't seem manipulative.
just wondering, Trump has all these, the golf resorts and in Mar-a-Lago, which is just this beautiful place that any of us would want to go on vacation. But did he show you how he relaxes? Does he enjoy being in those spaces? Or what is he going to do to decompress?
I think he is, he's a highly peripatetic person. So this one night when I was in my room huddling under the covers in fetal position at Mar-a-Lago, I got a call from his butler who later became infamous. Some of you read about him. But and Trump had been out to a movie. I hadn't gone with him. And he'd come back, and he was going to have dinner. So come down to the ballroom there. And they had a screen, and they were going to watch a fight, you know, some closed-circuit fight. So I was there, and we were watching this. And that I guess that was relaxation for him, was watching a boxing match, eating dinner there. You know, his family, his kid was there, and his, you know, retinue, whatever that amounted to, of security people. And Marla Maples was there, and I asked her, you know, if she liked boxing. And she said, I like it a lot, just so long as no one gets hurt.
One last question.
Okay. See, I spend a lot of the time when I watch Trump watching his hair. And I wonder if you can shed any light on that for us.
That's such an excellent question.
Thank you.
You're forcing me to think. I just think that his hair, if nothing else, is a real. It exists to challenge writers to figure out ways to describe it, because it has gotten more elaborate. Certainly,
it's grown.
You're not going to believe this, but I used to go to a barber on the Upper East Side who I told him that when I was writing about Trump, he claimed that he was Trump's barber too, and that he knew what was going on with his hair. And then I couldn't get him to tell me what it was. I don't think he ever lied to me any other time, so I don't think this was a lie, but I no idea. But you know, there was that famous. There's a book that's this guy that Trump thinks is worse looking than me, Harry Hurt. And there's a scene in that book where Trump is tearing Ivana's hair out, and basically sexually assaulting her. Not funny one iota, because he had been losing hair on top, and she. Had told him about something called scalp reduction surgery, and they actually would remove the bald spot surgically, you know, God almighty, and it didn't work, and he was in pain, and she described this, and she told this, and there was a whole legal thing about it beforehand, and you know, so he wasn't gonna, she couldn't claim that he raped her, although that's plainly what happened. So that part is not too funny.
I think it's all in their divorce proceedings.
Yeah.
And that's what Harry Hurt was drawing on.
That's
in
what
court
he was drawing.
Papers.
Right.
And she used the word rape in her divorce proceedings. And then when Harry Hurt's book came out, the publisher had been forced by, I think, whatever the Trump representatives were, to put a little note in the flyleaf that says, from Ivana, I didn't mean rape in a legal sense. It just, whatever the alternative is, I'm not really sure. But
I didn't mean rape in the sense of having my property settlement renegotiated.
Right. So anyway, but that you're right, there's this alarming hair scene. Maybe this is finally something that investigative reporters need to take on. I don't know. But
are you available?
I may be, but, you know, just to follow up, did he ever invite you to touch it?
You know, I'm going to tell you a different story. When I was starting out as a talk of the town reporter, I used to try to get out of Manhattan all the time as much as I could. And so there was I found this place on right off the boardwalk on Coney Island in Brighton Beach, and I used to go there. And I found these people dancing there one night in the summer. It was a senior citizen center, a Jewish senior citizen center, and they were just having a wonderful time out dancing by the seashore on a summer evening. And I was talking to someone. I had this little notebook in my hand, and I was leaning over, speaking to someone who was sitting in a chair. And all of a sudden, I hear this, I feel this tugging at my hair. And I look up, and it's this classic little Jewish lady. And I said, yes? And she said, I just want to know, is that your real hair? And it taught me never to do that to anyone else.
Thank you, Mark. On that note, what a great time. Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.